Welcome to another issue of David Greenwald's Mastermind Power Coaching Club audio tape series. For this interview, David spoke with Dr. Edward Abramson, Ph.D. Dr. Abramson is a professor of psychology at California State University, Chico. In private practice for over 20 years, he specializes in the cognitive behavioral treatment of eating disorders, anxiety disorders, and depression. He has directed a hospital-based outpatient eating disorders program and conducted workshops for health professionals. His work has been featured in the Washington Post, the New York Times, Reader's Digest, Smithsonian, and Cosmopolitan. Dr. Abramson was also a featured guest on the television news program 2020, with an entire segment devoted to weight gain related to marriage. If you are not presently a member of the Coaching Club, then please listen to the end of the tape for information telling you exactly how you can go about joining David's Mastermind Power Coaching Club. For now, sit back, put your thinking cap on, and listen to David Greenwald and Edward Abramson as they discuss the potential pitfalls of weight gain related to marriage.
I'd like to welcome everyone to another sure-to-be-fantastic interview of the experts. Today I have Dr. Edward Abramson with me, and we're going to talk about a subject that typically is only discussed, or should I say argued about, behind the closed doors of married couples. That topic is weight gain that occurs after being married. Anyone with eyes that can see and who has friends or relatives who are married will agree that it's almost mandatory for married couples to let themselves go and gain 25 to 50 pounds after a few years. Or is it mandatory? Dr. Abramson, welcome to the interview, and thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to speak with me today about this very important topic.
It's my pleasure.
Dr. Abramson, you state that marriage can be fattening. What do you mean by this statement?
Well, a bunch of changes occur following marriage, and unfortunately, many of the changes can contribute to weight gain.
Now, what are some of these changes?
Well, the most obvious one is that you stop dating. Given the emphasis that we put on appearance and on weight, many women, when they're adolescents, when they're young adults, and they're dating, will sometimes resort to almost extreme measures to maintain their weight at what they see as a desirable level. Now, it takes a lot of effort and energy to do this, and once they get married, they frequently feel that the pressure is off, and it's kind of hard to maintain that same degree of effort when there isn't the same degree of motivation. So probably the first change is just that anything extreme or effortful that a woman might have been doing before marriage becomes less urgent. But there are also lifestyle changes that come with being married, especially if we're talking about being a mother and raising kids. If someone once called motherhood the most fattening job in the world, because if you're a stay-at-home mom, you're working all day long doing tasks that frequently aren't all that interesting and maybe frustrating or boring, and you're never more than a few feet away from the refrigerator. And if you think about almost any other job, it's harder to gain access to food, and certainly it's not there continuously. Even if you work in the food service industry, even if you're a cook or a waitress or what have you, you're not allowed to just nibble all day long while you're in the restaurant's kitchen. On the other hand, if you're a mom, it's always there tempting you, and it's always an opportunity to take a break from activities that might not be so interesting. Then, aside from motherhood, when you get married, you lose your independence in terms of food choices. If you're single, you get to decide where you want to eat. If you're eating out, you get to decide what you want to prepare for dinner. If you're feeling weight conscious or health conscious with regard to, you know, eating, you get to exercise those options. On the other hand, once you get married, it becomes important traditionally to, even if your husband's a cook, to consider his wishes, and if he can eat more than you do, or if he's less weight conscious or less health conscious than you are, then invariably, at the very least, there's going to be temptation to do the same kind of thing that he does. And so frequently, you know, the ability to make your own choices decreases once you're married.
Okay. So you've listed a number of things or contributing factors for why women may be gaining weight after marriage. Why is there such a focus in your book, To Have and To Hold, How to Take Off the Weight When Marriage Puts on the Pounds, there does seem to be a concentrated focus on the women. Why is that?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, probably at some point I should write a similar book for men. But it does seem that women are more concerned about the weight gain and are more, you know, perplexed by it and wanting to do something about it. I think as a general rule, there are exceptions, of course, but as a general rule, men are more casual about it and would be probably less motivated to try and do something to offset weight gain with marriage or getting older.
I understand. So it has everything to do with looks. I should say has everything to do with looks, but looks are just far more important.
Yeah, when you think about it, despite the fact that feminism has been kind of a social movement for, I don't know, 30 years, women are still, to a large extent, evaluated on their appearance. And even a woman who is very accomplished professionally, well-educated, successful, if she is feeling that she's looking a little too fat or has put on some weight recently, that is going to have, I think, a greater impact on her self-esteem and her sense of well-being than it would be for a guy who's gained the same number of pounds over the same period of time.
Can you explain to our listeners, basically at least, why that is? I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, too, and I agree. I'm just trying to make sure that it's clear why.
Well, traditionally, men have been evaluated for their accomplishments, their achievements.
Okay.
You know? Especially once we're finished with adolescence, then, you know, how much money you make or how many promotions you get or the type of car you drive or these other kinds of data symbols or evidence of accomplishment are, you know, very important to men. On the other hand, women traditionally have been evaluated for their appearance. So even if they are very successful, actually, one of my graduate students was a director of a commercial weight loss program before she went back to graduate school. And her office, the office for this program, was in downtown San Francisco in the financial district. And she had all these high-powered women, attorneys and accountants and very successful, educated women, who then would come in to discuss their weight issues, and they would feel kind of helpless and incompetent when it came to that, even though in other areas of their life they were quite accomplished.
It's interesting. And in essence, basically what you're saying, too, is that a man may have a belly protruding over his belt, but he says, hey, I am the one at least primarily responsible for the two cars in the garage, the house we live in. And
exactly. My favorite example is an uncle of mine. And I remember as a kid, he had a pot belly that stuck
sure.
out over his belt. But he could insist with a straight face that it was all muscle.
Yeah.
Refused to feel badly about it.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, you know, hard to imagine a woman making the same kind of statement and being as comfortable with it as he apparently was.
I agree totally. There are a number of derailing things that can sabotage the efforts of the most well-intended husband or wife who needs to lose weight. How do we identify these derailing situations before they occur? I know you've stated in your book, and I totally agree, that if we can identify them ahead of time, maybe we can do something about them before they occur, or at least recognize them when they do occur.
Yeah, there are a bunch of different things that kind of creep up subtly and then can become habits, and frequently we're not aware of them because there's nothing that's particularly dramatic that's occurred.
Right.
So that, for instance, if you get married, let's say, and your husband, you had been doing fairly well not eating desserts with dinner, and your husband insists that there is ice cream in the freezer over a period of a year or whatever, you will undoubtedly have, you know, sampled.
Sure.
And so if you can become aware of, let's say, that that's a factor, then you can negotiate with your husband that if he wants to have his ice cream, maybe he can, you know, go to Baskin-Robbins or go someplace and have his ice cream outside of the home, or have it with lunch rather than with dinner, so that it's not necessary to actually have it in the freezer in the house.
So one of the sabotages is when the other half of the marriage is not a fan of the plan to stay in shape or get in shape, and they want what they want when they want it. and they've got it in the freezer when they've got it.
Yeah, sometimes husbands can be unhelpful, and maybe that's an understatement.
Sure.
Some husbands really present their wives with a very conflicting message. On one hand, they will remind them that they should, you know, go on a diet or lose weight or not eat this or that. On the other hand, you know, they will get very upset if there isn't the ice cream in the freezer. Or, you know, on some occasions, some of my patients have told me about, you know, their husbands literally offering them food off the husband's plate and encouraging them to eat. So sometimes there's a very conflicting message.
Mark, this is continuation. There was a break in the tape. We had a cutoff in our long-distance service, and I'm continuing the interview with Dr. Abramson at this time, and we're continuing to talk about derailing things that and situations that can occur, and how we can identify them before they occur so that we can either head them off before they occur or understand what's going on when they do occur. Dr. Abramson, again, thank you for joining me again, and if we could just continue on from where we left off yesterday.
Yeah, some of the things that husbands do when they feel insecure with their wife's weight loss or the likelihood that she's going to lose weight. I mentioned a few yesterday, but there are some other ones that in a study that one of my graduate students did a few years back, she compared successful dieters with dieters who hadn't been so successful.
Okay.
And the less successful dieters reported that their husbands were more likely to bring home sweets as a reward for weight loss. In other words, after you lose weight, the husband would bring home food that you shouldn't be eating.
Congratulations, honey. Have some monkey fudge.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Or they would complain about being lonely when their wife left to go exercise, if she was going to go for a walk or go to a gym or something like that. They would frequently then, you know, have some kind of negative comments about it. And sometimes they would insist on snack foods in the house. So, you know, if she wanted to reduce her temptation and not have snack foods in the house, you know, he would notice that and then complain about it.
Yeah, it's not very helpful. And are most of these derailing things that men do intentional or unintentional?
Well, it's kind of hard to say. Sometimes an unfortunate pattern develops, and it evolves over a period of time. So it's not like someone sits down and decides, okay, I'm going to subvert my wife's diet today. But the weight sometimes becomes kind of a vehicle for expressing dissatisfaction. And then if, you know, he is feeling unhappy about one thing or another in the relationship, rather than express, you know, his concerns straightforwardly, he might then focus on the weight or use the weight as a way to kind of punish his wife for whatever it is he sees that's, you know, not fair.
Right, so it's things that he may be doing and that she may be doing with regard to weight may have absolutely nothing to do with the
exactly.
weight itself.
It's just that frequently weight is a tangible source of dissatisfaction. You know, you look at your partner and you see that she, you know, she's heavier than she used to be, and it's very easy to notice that and then express dissatisfaction about it.
Right.
If things aren't going well in other areas of the relationship, it might not be quite as obvious.
You've talked about a number of things that men do, and I'm sure rightfully so, men are as to blame as anything, but are there other derailing things and situations that can sabotage the efforts of the wife or husband with regard to losing weight that could be identified ahead of time that maybe aren't related to something that the husband is doing to the wife?
Right, right. There are lots of reasons why people who have been doing well on their weight loss program kind of at some point give up, and or they get distracted, and many of them are fairly predictable. So that when there's a major change in routine, for instance, if someone goes away on vacation, they may drop some of their eating habits that they've worked to acquire, or they may stop their exercise routine for the 2 weeks, let's say, that they're away on vacation. And then when they come back, they may neglect to pick them up.
Sure.
And so
a break in the routine.
That upsets routines. Being sick is another one. I mean, you may, you know, be accustomed to walking every other day, and then you're kind of laid up in bed for a week or two, and then, you know, when you're finally feeling better, it's hard to reestablish that habit. So anything that is disruptive of routines causes people frequently to give up on their programs. One study that was done in a university medical center, I think the University of Pittsburgh actually, found that emotional eating was the downfall in about 50% of dieting relapse. In other words, the person had been doing fairly well, and then they experienced some emotional turmoil, you know, whether it was related to something that made them feel very angry or very stressed or whatever.
Right.
And they had then a tendency to deal with the emotion by eating to make themselves feel better, to soothe themselves or whatever. But they, and, you know, typically when people eat emotionally, you know, it's not low-calorie, low-fat foods that they're
right.
going to soothe themselves with.
It's feel-good foods.
It's feel-good foods, right.
Right.
So then after they do that, then they, you know, they look at what they've done and they basically say, oh, the hell with it, I've blown my diet, and they get derailed.
Right.
So that's kind of a predictable thing. If a person knows that they are at risk for emotional eating, and they then have an episode in which they do eat emotionally, they need to be able to put that in context and then pick up where they left off rather than to feel that it's all hopeless and give up at that point.
So basically, if I understand what you're saying, is they need to identify the emotional triggers that are causing them to go to the refrigerator and eat the Ben & Jerry's.
Exactly.
And once they identify the emotional triggers, then they can begin to understand that, hey, every time my husband yells at me, or every time I have a bad day at work, or whatever it may be, I run to the refrigerator.
Yeah, my first book, which is called Emotional Eating, What You Need to Know Before Starting Another Diet,
right.
has some questionnaires in it so that you can identify your own pattern of emotional eating. Some folks are anxiety or stress eaters. Other folks actually don't eat when they get anxious or stressed. Some folks are depressed eaters. Some
right.
folks are angry eaters. Some folks eat when they're lonely or bored. And so if you can identify what your pattern is, then first of all, you can come up with other ways of dealing with your anxiety or your anger, hopefully without eating. But even if you then resort to emotional eating, at least you know when you're at risk for it, and then you can pick up and move on when that episode is over.
What suggestions, even if it's just a couple, because I know it would have to be probably incredibly unique for each person, I suppose, but what suggestions would you have for the person who says, okay, every single time my husband and I or my wife and I have a spat, I go to their fridge. Okay, I've identified it. This is something that it's a trigger for me, or when I have a bad day at work or whatever, it's a trigger for me. So now what? Now I've identified it.
Yeah, that's a good point. First of all, the thing I tell people most often is to make the risky foods less accessible. I mean, if you really have to have the Ben & Jerry's, get in the car and drive and get it, you know.
Great advice, yep.
As opposed to just walking over to the freezer and getting some. So if the foods are not in the house, it makes that kind of eating less likely.
I totally agree, and I'm just as guilty as every other living soul listening to this in that regard. If it's not in the house, and I'm just as guilty as anyone is succumbing to some emotional eating,
uh-huh.
if it's not in the house, I will choose a better food.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, I mentioned that in To Have and To Hold, that when I was actually writing the book, you know, there are long periods of time where you're sitting there and nothing comes to you, and it would be kind of tempting to wander off into the kitchen and see if there are any cookies.
Right.
And undoubtedly, if there were, you know...
Yeah, they're gone.
...have consumed a certain number.
Yeah.
The good news is that there weren't any in the house.
That's right.
So, you know, and the other thing I tell people to do sometimes is if a certain kind of situation is coming up which they can predict will be likely to provoke eating, to do it in whatever the situation is, to try and do it in a in an environment that doesn't have food. So maybe if you're going to have a stressful discussion with your husband, you don't want to do it in the kitchen.
Right.
You know, maybe the two of you should go for a ride and, you know, sit in the car and talk about it.
Sure. Detaching yourself from an area that would have your favorite foods and also not having the foods in the house are two great examples of what to do.
I tell students, for instance, who are struggling with weight and eating issues, that maybe they should do their homework in the library rather than do it in their apartments or in the dorm rooms where there's more food readily available.
Right. That makes perfect sense. I think this might be a good time to ask this question. As you had mentioned that, you know, some of the issues with regard to, you know, when we were talking about sabotaging, is there such a thing? I mean, people want to start losing weight or changing their physique whenever they're feeling bad about themselves or when they finally had it. But is there such a thing as a bad time to start a new eating lifestyle?
Well, probably there are some situations that are going to be more difficult than others. And so you probably need to evaluate that. It's any changing any habit requires effort and attention and concentration. I mean, if you think about learning, the example I always use is think about learning to drive a manual transmission. If you can do that, you know, you don't think about it at all. But
right.
The first few times you did it, your attention was focused on it, and you had to mentally tell yourself, you know, what to do with the clutch pedal and the gas pedal, etc. So anytime you're learning a new habit, it requires the ability to concentrate and focus and work on something. So what that suggests is if your life is in turmoil in other ways, if you've just moved, for instance, and your house is still disorganized and, you know, you haven't put everything away.
Right.
Or if someone in the family has been taken ill and you're running to the hospital and very preoccupied with that, it's unlikely that you would have the mental resources available to focus on, you know, changing eating habits, changing exercise habits. So all things considered, you're likely to have more success tackling this when you can focus on it and when the other areas in your life are not demanding as much of your attention.
It's quite a balancing act from the clients that I've dealt with, too, to try and determine when exactly it is that's optimal for beginning a new, you know, leanest lifestyle of sorts, and when it is really just a continuation of excuses not to start.
Yeah, right. I mean, a person has to be motivated.
Right.
And, you know, one thing that has to happen is that a person has to recognize none of this occurs automatically.
Right.
Or without any effort. And if someone is still intent on finding some miracle cure that's going to, you know, allow them to go to sleep at night and wake up and find themselves thinner and fitter, then this, you know, if they're still looking for that, then
success rate is.
Tell them to come back.
Yeah.
When you're thoroughly frustrated.
Right. Right, exactly.
You need to do something different.
Exactly. All right. Let's talk about cravings a minute, because in your book you talk about cravings. If I understand it correctly, I'd like you to explain it. How is a craving for food different than a like or a want for food?
Well, when you crave a food, I mean, everybody has preferences, and that's, you know, that makes life interesting, to look forward to eating something that you enjoy. And there's nothing, you know, no problem with that. Craving occurs, though, when you become preoccupied with the food and it's kind of in the forefront of your consciousness and you feel uncomfortable until you actually get the food. And
it's something that's, it's a feeling, it's something that becomes overwhelming.
Well, it's uncomfortable.
It's uncomfortable.
You basically have the feeling that you're not going to be happy until you've satisfied the craving, until you've found the food and had some of it.
Okay.
That's the bad part about it. The good part about it is that it goes away eventually. How long? You know, it's usually 15 minutes or somewhere in that vicinity. The craving will subside.
So if you can hang on for 15 minutes, you're going to be in better shape.
Yeah, right. You can get on with whatever
right.
whatever else you're going to do that day and not be so preoccupied with the food.
You also state in your book that if we decrease the urgency of the craving, it's easier to resist until the craving is gone. How do we decrease the urgency?
Well, frequently, especially for women, I think, the cravings are associated, again, with this emotional turmoil. I don't know that that's true 100% of the time, but a fair percentage of the time, cravings seem to be preceded by some kind of emotional turmoil. And so if you figure out what your pattern is and develop your own strategy for relaxing yourself if you're stressed, or making yourself feel better if you're depressed, or calming yourself if you're angry, then probably the strength of the craving, well, it may not occur, but if it does occur, probably will have less intensity to it. Frequently, what I try and encourage people to do, sometimes you can do it, doesn't work 100% of the time, is to distract themselves when they're feeling a craving. If you're home alone, for instance, and you've got a craving, one thing that at least a few people have told me helps is they turn up the stereo and, you know, to some disco music and dance around the living room like crazy.
Just anything to pass the time.
Right.
Until it, something they enjoy to pass the time until the craving subsides.
Right. And if you distract yourself, then the craving, doesn't seem so important anymore.
It's very true. You were talking about cravings being related to some kind of emotional turmoil. And in your book, you go into great detail describing an 8-step sequence for resolving annoyance without angry outbursts or eating.
Uh-huh.
I found this very interesting. So can you briefly tell us the difference between being annoyed and being angry, and which one is more appropriate most of the time for with respect to keeping food in check?
Yeah. Angry feelings typically come from a sense of being treated unfairly. You know, if you think about the things that tend to make you angry, or the last time you were angry, typically someone else did something that you thought was unfair. You know, someone took the parking spot that you were waiting for, you know.
Right.
Someone cut ahead of you, you know, on a line in a supermarket or something like that. It's not fair. You were there first. They shouldn't have done that. And so this is not to suggest that you should be, you know, not respond or not do anything differently.
Right.
Being annoyed, I think, is constructive, and it's a signal that you may need to, in the instance of someone cutting in line in the supermarket, you may need to say something to that person. A lot of situations, though, that would typically provoke anger, the anger is, it doesn't accomplish anything. I mean, if someone cuts in front of you when you're driving and you get angry, you don't have any continuing contact with that person. I mean, that person is not going to be involved in the rest of your life.
Right.
And truthfully, whatever it was, you know, his cutting in front of you is over and done with, and there's nothing else, you know, that's going to happen there. So getting all worked up, because anger frequently includes physiological arousal, which then is fairly uncomfortable. Most of us don't like what's the feeling in our body when we're angry.
Right.
And then some of us will eat to soothe that feeling or to calm ourselves down, you know, feeling after having that kind of arousal experience. So it's more sensible, I think, in almost all situations to recognize that you're annoyed. He or she shouldn't have done that. But to put it in context so that you don't have to experience the full physical arousal of a real angry outburst.
Sounds like it's advice to at least try to understand that a lot of times it's not the situation that is causing your anger, it's your perception of the situation.
Exactly. What you're doing is using your ability to think rationally,
right,
to put the situation in context. And when you do that, you realize that getting all physically worked up isn't helping you any, and it certainly is not doing anything to correct the situation. And if you can count to 10 or look at it philosophically, this is one of life's minor irritants, and not get worked up, then I think it's better for your health, and probably you're less likely to resort to eating.
That's great advice. Thank you for that. many people believe their metabolism slows down after age 25. I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who just say, well, 30 years old now, you know, my metabolism has slowed down. Has their metabolism really slowed down, or are there other reasons they believe their metabolism has slowed down?
Well, that's a real good question. There is evidence that, you know, people gain weight with age.
Right.
And whether it is actually a slowing down of metabolism as they get older, or whether something else is going on, and the most obvious explanation is that when people get older, they get more sedentary and less active, and as they get less active, then obviously their metabolism does slow down, but it's not, maybe that it's not so much age, but just the decrease in activity levels.
Right. It gives them the appearance. You see, I think that a lot of people forget, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I think a lot of people forget that when they were 21 and under, they were far more active than they are when they're 30.
There's no question that that is a major contributing factor to weight problems. I mean, relatively small differences in activity level over time can produce significant weight gain. Someone suggested, and I think had some evidence to suggest, that even people who fidget may use up 800 calories a day.
Exactly, I've read that too.
More than people who don't fidget.
Sure. You discussed that there are several primary reasons why anyone can be overweight, and it relates to this metabolism issue we're talking about, and gets more to the core of why people are really overweight, and not that their metabolism has somehow, although I believe it is physiologically possible for that to occur, especially from my understanding in women, maybe after they've had children, certain things can change.
Well, there are some differences. I mean, there is a genetic component,
right,
to obesity. Someone estimated that somewhere between 25 and 40% of the variance is inherited. And what the specific mechanism is, or maybe there may be more than one mechanism, so that, you know, may be different from me than it is from you,
sure,
or someone else, is not clear. But some people may luck out and basically be more inefficient. This is one time where I guess it's good to be inefficient in burning calories, and other efficient calorie burners then tend, you know, to gain weight more easily. So there may be, you know, some genetic factors contributing to that.
Okay. So one of the primary reasons would be genetics.
Yeah, but even so, that doesn't preclude, you know, losing weight, or doesn't necessarily doom one to guaranteed obesity. There's in Colorado, they've got a registry of people who have lost weight, and significant amount of weight, and kept it off for over 5 years. And, you know, they've been studying these folks and trying to determine, you know, how they succeeded. And one of the things they found out was that a fair percentage of them, in fact, had two parents who were overweight. So the implication is that even if there is a genetic predisposition to being fat, it doesn't mean that you necessarily have to be fat.
And I think that is agreed upon even more, and backed up even more with the twin studies,
yeah,
that they've done, where you take a twin and they're separated at birth, and one is raised by a, you know, a fairly healthy oriented family, and the other twin is raised by Doritos and Burger King.
Uh-huh.
And even though they were predisposed, like you said, at birth to maybe being overweight, there's a significant difference after 20 years.
Yeah.
So, okay, so we've got genetics, and we've got primarily environment, from what I'm understanding. I mean, as far as being
a lot of different ways, yeah.
As far as, yeah, reasons why people would be overweight, or things that would be in control, are there other reasons that come to mind?
Well, let me just say one more thing about genetics.
Okay.
And that is probably where genetics plays a really critical role, is that I think is worthwhile understanding, is in the location of fat deposits on a body. So that it probably is genetic that some people will have a bigger butt, or some people will have more fat on their arms or
right
midsection, and that is unlikely to change. So that even if you lose weight, people need to recognize realize that they may still not be 100% satisfied with the appearance, let's say, of their butt.
Sure.
And that, I think, if you understand that, that can help people be more realistic in what their goals are for weight loss, and therefore more likely to succeed because they're less likely to get frustrated and give up.
Okay, great.
This program continues at this point on Side B.
Moving on again, what is dietary independence and how do we achieve it? You talked a lot about how men influence their wives' eating, and I'm sure the wives most definitely influence the men's eating. There are certain foods that men enjoy that if the wife doesn't like the food, she simply won't prepare it. And since the wife, generally speaking, is normally still the preparer of the foods in homes today in the United States, how does dietary independence come into play here and how do we achieve it?
Well, you know, again, if other things in the relationship are going well, the couple, I think, should be able to negotiate so that he's not feeling deprived because she doesn't want to eat certain foods and she's not feeling that she has to be tempted because of his food preferences. And I think it becomes possible for them to come to an understanding about which foods that he likes that are difficult for her, how they can work around it. Sometimes, if they have to have snack foods in the house, it's possible for them to buy snack foods that she doesn't like to keep other people happy, but so that she'll experience less temptation. Other times it makes more sense for instance, let's say there's a family and the wife is tempted by ice cream, but the husband and the kids want to have it, and it can become a kind of a family ritual that the husband takes the kids to Baskin-Robbins or wherever to get the ice cream, and she can do something that can be her time to do something nice for herself that doesn't involve eating ice cream.
Well, you know, it sounds like dietary independence is simply a furthering of communication and acceptance of each other, just as it is with any other part of the relationship.
Exactly.
Just as I'm listening to you,
it takes a little bit of planning and a lot of communication.
I keep hearing working together as you're speaking, and I keep hearing give and take.
Yeah, and usually what you can do is get the issue of eating and weight doesn't have to be a source of contention or conflict within a relationship. Actually, it can be something that is kind of mutually rewarding.
And I know I read in your book that one of the examples was a couple actually became, and this is not uncommon, I have personal experience with this as well, but a couple became much closer when their goals were similar.
Yeah, and then it allows for kind of rituals to develop that are nice. If the two of them go for a walk every morning or on weekends or something like that, that can be a time that, you know, they feel they enjoy each other's company and create good feelings.
Great. That's great advice. These are very helpful tips and ideas for all the married couples out there listening to this. Now, you've talked about things that a man can do, but I want to just see if there are other things that we haven't covered. You talked about maybe the man taking the kids out for ice cream instead of having the ice cream in the home. What are three things a man can do to help his wife achieve a healthy and attractive weight? The reason I ask that question is I want to get from you, and I want to see if you can stress this, that we're treading on some waters here that are not real calm a lot of times, and you're on thin ice about half the time, I think. And I think most of the men out there listening would agree, and the wives would have to agree if they really think about it, that, I mean, it's a hard subject to approach. If you do too much, you're going to be criticized. If you don't do enough, you're going to be criticized. So what are some things a man can do besides take the kids out for ice cream and try not to force, you know, his snack preferences in the home to help his wife?
Well, one thing is to be supportive. You know, we get into a habit of identifying negative things or things we don't like and commenting. You know, if she's eating a piece of cake or something like that, it's very easy to comment, make a negative comment about that.
Right. You really need that cake.
It's less obvious, but far more productive to find an instance where she's resisted temptation or, you know, let's say snacked on something that was healthy, and then compliments her for it. Now, you know, you have to know how, what the best way of each individual receives compliments differently.
Sure.
And so, you know, you have to do it in a way that is comfortable for your wife, but it could even just be an expression that, you know, she's doing well, or, you know, some kind of hug, or
sure,
even a joking comment that's taken, you know, in a supportive sort of a way would work. But basically, instead of focusing on the instances where she's not doing well, and no one's going to be perfect here,
sure,
but focusing on when she is doing well and giving her, acknowledging that, I think that's very helpful. Another thing that a person can do is to recognize that weight loss doesn't always follow any specific, you know, one of the frustrating things about working on weight is that you can do well with, you know, exercise and watching what you're eating, and the scale may not show it that week.
Right.
There are a variety of different reasons why that happens. So rather than evaluating success based on the scale, the spouse can recognize that as long as she is doing the kinds of things that she's supposed to be doing in terms of eating habits and activity, that, you know, he should, again, be supportive of that. You know, rather than emphasize weight loss per se, the husband should emphasize improvements in behavior and recognize them regardless of what the scale is saying. And a husband can also be helpful by suggesting activities that the two of them can enjoy together that involve, you know, some physical exertion. So he can suggest that they go for a walk, or he can, you know, invite her to participate in, you know, golf if that's his thing, or whatever, you know, kind of activity that the two of them could do together would be very helpful.
Would it be helpful? I've had several clients that have asked this particular question, or they've mentioned this, and I don't really know how to take this, but there'll be a woman, she's not real happy with her weight. She's maybe 25, 30, 40 pounds overweight, in her own mind at least, and she would like to get the weight down, but you know what? The husband is actually perfectly fine with it, and he conveys that to her. He doesn't sabotage her in any way necessarily, and doesn't, you know, offer her snacks and do the things that are hurtful, but his comments will be more like, you know what, I think you're fine just as you are. Is that helpful, or should he recognize that when he says that, that doesn't help?
Well, one concern that I would have, and it's hard to know in the abstract,
right,
but is that his sincere belief,
mm-hmm,
or is he perhaps just a little concerned about what will happen if she loses weight?
Okay.
Some husbands are okay with that, and other husbands maybe are less okay with it, but are concerned that if the wife loses weight, then maybe she'll be more attractive to other guys, or maybe she'll feel better about herself and then, you know, be more curious about other guys. So sometimes there's kind of an implicit threat when the wife loses weight, and so the husband says, everything's fine the way you are, don't bother losing.
Right, so there's a very big security issue going on, or that may be going on. It may be very sincere.
Right, right. Or it could be just that he is fine with it. Even if he's fine with, you know, with his wife being overweight, he can recognize that even small changes in terms of weight loss, 5 to 10% weight reductions, have significant health benefits.
Sure.
And so, you know, he could encourage her to make relatively small changes in her weight just for the health benefits. And even if she's still somewhat overweight at that point, maybe that would be a good compromise.
Okay, great. Like I say, there are muddy waters out there.
Yeah, it's rarely straightforward.
Mm-hmm. You know, for the man, it's a unique situation in every case, in that, you know, the woman is going to have to figure out, is he really sincere, like you said, or is he in some way trying to hold her down? Because as I've read in your book and so forth, and it's absolutely true that if there's a significant weight loss, it can really change personality, can really change how they perceive themselves, how they are perceived, and it, as we'll talk in a minute here, it can maybe even reduce the suit of armor.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, we've talked about some of the things that a man can do, and we've talked about a few things that he shouldn't do, but are there some other things that a man should never do if he thinks he's helping his wife to lose weight, or if he thinks he's, if he wants to help his wife lose weight, what are some things he should never say or do?
One thing I think is really make disparaging comments. You know, telling, you know, a woman that, you know, she's too fat, or, you know, fat is a turnoff or something like that.
Right.
Probably, I can't see any reason why someone would do that who's trying to be helpful.
Okay.
So I would be particularly concerned about that kind of thing, because it just creates bad feelings.
Should a man ask his wife if she's the one primarily concerned with the weight and is in some type of program to lose it? Should he ask her, how are you doing? How are you doing on your new program? How are you doing on your diet? Or should he let her start any communications regarding diet and weight loss?
Yeah, typically I think the best strategy is for the husband to be interested, but to let the wife take the lead. One thing that I'm firmly convinced about working with overweight people, but with anorexics and bulimics as well, is that no one gains weight or loses weight for anybody else.
Sure.
If they're going to do it, it has to be because they want to do it. And so I think to the extent that the husband is perceived as checking up, you know, he's the teacher and
right,
and he's checking the wife's homework assignment or something like that, I think then you're reducing the likelihood that she's actually going to be motivated to do it for herself. So I think he should be accessible, he should be interested, he should pay attention, but he should do that all in the context of her taking the lead.
Okay.
So he could maybe ask a general question, how are things going, but other than that, let her volunteer.
Okay, great. Now, let's assume that a wife, you've mentioned before, and you stress it in your book, that women will do a lot better if they have the support of their husband.
Mm-hmm.
How should a wife let her husband know that she wants his help?
Well, I think she should be specific in asking him to do certain things so that, you know, she can say that, you know, help me prepare a shopping list, or, you know, encourage me to go for a walk with you or something like that. She can tell him what it is that she would like him to do and try and be fairly specific, and at any one time probably not overwhelm him with a number of different things to do.
Right.
You know, start with, you know, one or two things, and then later on, if appropriate, add some more.
So don't assume he's a mind reader and try to give him some specific guidelines on what to do.
Yeah. Clearly, this is something that the more specific you can be, I think the better off both people will be.
What impact does an unhappy marriage versus a happy marriage have on weight gain?
Well, there was one study which was done by Dr. Richard Stewart. And I think they got the data from one of the women's magazines. They had a survey in one of the women's magazines, and they found that after 13 years of marriage, happily married women gained weight. They, I think, were gaining somewhere around 18 pounds, I think. And that's, I guess, what you would expect given that everyone gets older.
Right.
But unhappily married women had gained something like 43 pounds in the same time period. So there was a significantly larger weight gain associated with being in an unhappy marriage.
Okay. So it's at least something to understand, and it doesn't necessarily mean that if your friends are a little bit above normal that they have an unhappy marriage.
Right. You can't jump to that kind of conclusion. But it's quite likely that people who are unhappy in their marriage, or maybe even unhappy in other areas of their life as well, use food to make themselves feel better.
Okay, great. Now, when people are dieting, or when they're losing a pound and a half, 2 pounds a week, and they're doing whatever new plan they're on, and things are moving along, and they're seeing this change, I usually call that the honeymoon phase, but there are a number of terms for it. But when they're actually going through the process before they reach their either ideal or goal weight, things are usually great if things are moving well.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say they reach their goal weight, or they reach a weight that they believe they can live with. Now we're moving away from the honeymoon phase into maintenance.
Yeah.
How do we get people to think that they're, that change is basically transparent? There should be basically no difference between the honeymoon phase and the maintenance phase. How do we get people to think, go from thinking dieting to
lifestyle? What happens sometimes, I think, is that people get disappointed if their expectations for weight loss have been unrealistic. Some folks who have been overweight for years and years and years typically view all of life's dissatisfactions or problems, attribute them all to their weight. You know, if I was only thinner, then I would have gotten this promotion. If I was only thinner, then my relationship would have been better. If I was only thinner, I would have more dates. If I was only thinner, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
And, you know, the reality is that people who aren't struggling with their weight have hassles in their lives, too. And so sometimes I think what happens is that people lose weight and find out that, you know, life is not, still not perfect.
Sure.
And so there's bound to be some disappointment if those are your expectations going into it.
Okay.
Another thing that sometimes happens is that people will plateau at a level that is still above their ideal weight. Some people, I think, have a notion of ideally what they would weigh, and the reality is that may be unrealistic for them.
Sure.
And so they may have done well and improved their appearance and significantly improved their health risks, but still have a feeling that they should be, you know, 10 pounds or 20 pounds lighter, and that just may not be realistic, and it may be very difficult physically to accomplish that goal. And since they can't seem to do it, then they may get frustrated. They may have kind of an all-or-none mentality. If I can't be at my, you know, absolutely ideal, perfect weight, then what the hell?
Right. So there needs to be some kind of acceptance at some point in time where they accept that they were just 10 pounds away from their goal, and this is it.
And this is good.
Right.
You know, it may be that, yeah, my thighs are still not as thin as I would like them to be, or, you know, I'm still not, still don't quite look like a supermodel.
Right.
But this is a big improvement over the way it was before, and quite an accomplishment, and I should be pleased with it.
Yeah, great. And one of the things I try to stress, too, is that if they're doing the things that we consider right, you know, exercising, eating the right foods, trying to eat according to the pyramid, getting a variety of foods, and just doing the things that are generally healthy, and they get to that point where they're 10 pounds above their goal weight, gosh, we really don't have any reason to be beating them up, do we?
No.
And they don't have any reason to be beating themselves up.
Yeah. I think that, you know, when one gets to a plateau, rather than be frustrated at the plateau, I think that's really an opportunity to adapt to that weight. And in fact, it may take a while for you to become comfortable with that weight. It may take a while for other people to be comfortable with you at that weight.
Sure.
If they're accustomed over years to seeing a person as being heavy and they're considerably less heavy, you know, that may take some adjustment on their part as well. And so that's kind of a time for consolidating gains, so to speak. And then after several months or however long, if you then decide that you want to work and see if you can lose some more, if that's a reasonable decision to make, or if you decide that this is pretty good, I'm going to be comfortable at that, this weight, even if it wasn't my original goal, that's also a reasonable decision to make. But the plateau, I think, gives you an opportunity to make the adjustments to accept that weight.
Does the transition from a thought of dieting to a lifestyle, it seems like it would actually begin, or should begin, when you begin the new nutritional regimen. I mean, if you come across a plan that works for you and it's balanced and healthy and would be considered good with respect to nutritional density and all the factors that everyone is mostly familiar with that we're not going to get into here, mm-hmm. You want to begin that process, if I understand you correctly, with the thought that it's, I am not dieting, this, I am beginning a new lifestyle.
Exactly. I mean, and it's a lifestyle. You know, since I'm changing habits, initially I will have to focus more energy, more of my mental effort on developing this new habit. But after a period of time, the habit will become more or less routine, and it won't be that I'm even as preoccupied with it as I was initially. And so the notion of, quote, being on a diet kind of fades away,
into a more or less natural lifestyle.
Okay. Now, I have to admit, moving on to another subject here, that I've been guilty of assigning morality terms to having pleasure foods.
Uh-huh.
You talk about this in your book. You talk about assigning morality terms like cheat meals to describe having that one or two meals a week, which is, you know, anything you want.
Uh-huh.
What's a better way to think and talk about these types of meals? We don't want to call them cheat meals.
Yeah. You know, I think you can allow for them, basically, you know, without attaching
some kind of guilt,
evaluative terms to them, good, bad, you know, cheating or not cheating or whatever. If the plan that you develop includes, you know, an occasional indulgence, that's fine.
Right.
And enjoy it. I always encourage people, I say, if you're going to have, you know, your favorite dessert or something like that, make a big deal out of it. Sit down and enjoy it. Give it the attention it deserves, you know. Savor it, you know. Don't feel guilty and gobble it up hurriedly because you're feeling so badly about it.
Sure.
That's kind of foolish. You're not getting what you need out of it.
I've got to find a new term for it.
Yeah.
I've got to move away from cheat meals. You discussed several pleasures that we should seek while going through a weight loss process, some kind of different rewards and so forth. One of them is buying new clothes.
Uh-huh.
You state that we should not postpone buying new clothes until we've reached our goal. A lot of people say, I'm not buying those new pair of pants until I'm a size 12, and I'm not buying them until I'm a size 8.
Well, one thing that I mentioned earlier, that I had a graduate student who used to work director of a commercial weight loss program, and she would always tell the women that even if they didn't want to buy new pants, let's say, but they enjoyed shopping, they could go out and buy new shoes or new accessories or whatever that, you know, weren't dependent on a given size.
So it's not an either-or scenario.
Right.
Either I'm buying...
One of the problems that happens, I think, is that women will deprive themselves. They'll kind of put their life on hold until they've reached their goal. So, you know, they won't go on a cruise until they've lost 20 pounds, or they won't, you know, ride a bicycle because they look ridiculous at their weight, or they won't go to the high school reunion because they'll look too fat, or they won't go shopping because et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what happens then is they end up depriving themselves of a lot of the potential joys in life. And if you deprive yourself of other sources of joy, then food becomes even that much the more important as a source of joy.
Right.
And so I think it's better to allow yourself pleasure in, you know, other areas in your life so that you don't feel quite so deprived if you're missing some of the pleasure that you get out of eating, snacks a lot.
So, you know, essentially, don't put your life on hold.
Exactly.
Yeah, great advice. Now, let's talk about, we've kind of come away from this, now we're coming back to it a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about how intimacy may change in marriage when the weight loss is occurring. What are some common experiences and feelings a woman might expect to have as she loses 3 or 4 dress sizes, and how does fat act as this protective armor? I'm using your words.
Right. I'll give you some examples. One woman reported that she was losing weight, and she, you know, went to a gym, and she, I guess, ride the exercise bike.
Sure.
She was noticing that as she was losing weight, guys were checking her out.
Mm-hmm.
And since she had been heavy for quite some time, this was a new experience, and, you know, it's, for most women, I think it's probably kind of a mixed blessing. On one hand, you like the notion that you're attractive or possibly attractive to members of the opposite sex, but on the other hand, you feel uncomfortable when people are scrutinizing your body parts.
Right.
And so I think a lot of women, you know, learn to deal with it, and rightly or wrongly, you know, they just cope with it.
Sure.
But this woman apparently hadn't had this experience for quite some time, and was very uncomfortable, and in many respects was kind of tempted to, you know, let the weight creep back in so that she didn't have to deal with that uneasiness.
Was the weight then her protective armor?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically.
It protected her from...
It shielded her. In the book, I think I have an example of a woman who'd had experiences earlier on in her life where she received unwanted sexual attention.
Okay.
And she gained weight, and this decreased the... the likelihood that that would happen. And it's unfortunate that women, you know, have to experience this, but it's just much better to develop ways of letting people know that you're not interested or that this is inappropriate than having to rely on weight gain to do it for you.
What about within the marriage itself, between the husband and wife?
Sometimes this... I talk about weight as a chastity belt. Occasionally you'll have a couple where he may be feeling somewhat inadequate about himself, his own appearance, his own attractiveness, his own skills as a lover, and, you know, may feel that if she loses weight, then she may feel dissatisfied with him and look for someone who's more attractive or a better lover or something along those lines. And so he may be motivated to see her keep her weight so he doesn't have to confront that issue. And sometimes weight will serve to stabilize a relationship. Well, one couple that I worked with a while back, both of them kind of implicitly knew this. She wanted to stay married to him, but she also was kind of, I think he was her first boyfriend, and she was kind of sexually curious about what else was
sure.
out there.
Right.
And she knew that, or felt that if she lost weight, she might be more tempted to stray, and as long as she was heavy, that was not very likely. And so she had a kind of a self-imposed chastity belt.
To keep herself from straying. It's very interesting.
And again, this is a very sensitive issue, and
sure.
frequently it's difficult to talk about, but it's unfortunate that couples have to use weight in order to solve those kinds of issues.
And what happens when the weight comes off is, it sounds like a lot of those issues simply become exposed. They don't necessarily start.
Right.
But if he's got a drinking problem and she never says anything because she's 75 pounds overweight and feels bad, sounds like when she gets the weight off, her
right,
confidence level...
And he's, you know, if she makes changes in her lifestyle so she can get weight off, then implicitly, and maybe even explicitly, there's pressure on him to make comparable changes, you know. If she can lose weight, he should be able to stop drinking. If she can lose weight, he should, you know, be able to do whatever he needs to do to advance at work.
Right.
You know, make some other changes in his life. And so, you know, in that sense, he may have a vested interest in keeping her heavy so that he doesn't have to make difficult changes.
Right, and it sounds like even if we brought it to the most innocent level, that these would be things that either a man or a woman would have to take into consideration for their partner. I mean, just even if there's not a drinking problem, even if he's doing just fine at work, if she wants to lose the 30 or 40 pounds, he may feel that some pressure has now been applied for him to do better in some area of his life, even if she doesn't think so at all.
Yeah, right, right. Frequently these expectations are, you know, not all that obvious, and they may be self-imposed. I mean, it may not be that she's saying, okay, I've lost weight, now you shape up.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But he just may have that kind of nagging doubt that if she loses weight, then... maybe I need to do better here or there.
With all of these psychological issues and these games that husbands and wives play and all of these, you know, I want you to lose weight, but here's some cake, and just all of this stuff going on back and forth and all of these implicit and explicit things that we signals and say this but don't say this, it sounds like there's, with everything out there, that there's going to come a time for some couples, maybe not for the majority, but for some, where they're going to need the services of a professional counselor or a psychologist instead of going it alone. Are there any credentials people listening to this particular interview should look for if they're in the market for help?
Well, I always tell people when they're looking for a therapist that first of all they should look at the individual, basically two things to look at. One is their technical expertise. Are they licensed as a psychologist or as a marriage therapist, or you know, what kind of training they've had?
Is clinical psychologist and psychiatrist, I mean, what, with regard to those credentials on the technical side, is marriage therapist, you know, where, you know, is it okay, are there some words that they should avoid, you know, if someone has this behind their name, it's probably not, they're probably not qualified, or basically if someone says, I'm a psychologist, or I'm a psychiatrist, or I'm a marriage therapist, all of those would be okay? Yeah, got you on the spot. Put you on the spot, yep.
They should be technically competent.
Okay.
But people specialize in different issues, and you have to be comfortable with the individual you're working with. And I think that's also a critical thing. So that someone could be technically competent and, you know, do very well, but you're just not comfortable with that person.
Right.
And if that's the case, getting a therapist is a very personal kind of a relationship. And so you need to be comfortable with the person as well as be, you know, impressed with their technical skills. So I always encourage people to call a therapist and spend a few minutes on the phone with them and ask questions of the therapist and, you know, see how you're feeling. It doesn't hurt to get referrals from friends. But, you know, recognize that what your friend was looking for might be different from what you're looking for. And also to recognize that, you know, go for a session or two, and at the end of the first session or second session, ask the therapist how he or she is conceptualizing your issues and what they think needs to be done and how long they think it's going to take and what kinds of procedures or methods will they use, and then decide whether you think that works for you. You know, I've had people come in to see me who basically said, you know, I went to see Dr. So-and-so, and you know, I liked him or her, but, you know, he wanted to do this or that, and, you know, I wasn't interested in doing that.
Sure.
I'm sure that some people who have seen me have gone on to see other therapists and said similar things, and I think that's perfectly appropriate.
Sure, it does need to be a fit within the personalities,
yeah,
doesn't it?
And ask, what is it that you're planning on doing, or how do you see, you know, what our sessions will be like, and hopefully they should be able to tell you in a way that makes sense to you.
Okay.
If it doesn't make sense to you, don't do it.
All right, great advice. Is there anything else you'd like to say to the married men and women out there where either one or both are struggling to make it all happen and put it all together with regard to the weight loss issues?
Yeah, basically be patient.
Okay.
Be consistent, be persistent, but also be patient.
Right.
Change doesn't occur overnight, and with something like weight, which, after all, we all eat many times during the day, it's unreasonable to expect perfection, but as long as you're moving in the right direction, keep at it.
Well, thank you again for speaking with me today, Dr. Abramson, and sharing your expertise on the psychology of marital weight gain. I'm sure couples everywhere will enjoy this interview and benefit from our discussion here today. The book is To Have and To Hold, How to Take Off the Weight When Marriage Puts on the Pounds by Dr. Edward Abramson and published by Kensington Publishing. Another book to consider is also Emotional Eating. Thank you again, Doctor, and have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn more about the Leanest Lifestyle and Club Lifestyle online, please visit www.leanestlifestyle.com. That's www.leanestlifestyle.com.